Welcome to the NJIOA 2025 Winter Retreat. In this workshop, we will be discussing the big book chapter called There is a Solution. Delighted to introduce today's speaker, Pete B. Whenever you're ready, please begin your presentation. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Julie. Appreciate that. Thanks, Kim, for being my timer. I'm also going to keep it just in case because I probably have a lot to cover, and I also want to make sure I get to all of it. So, hi, everybody. My name's Pete B. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm recovered today by God's grace and mercy. I have with the what Terry described earlier from the doctor's opinion, I have that condition. I have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind. I've been restored to sanity. I'm able to utilize all of the resources and faculties that my creator has put in me. And I walk a free man. I have food neutrality, and I've ceased fighting everybody and everything, and I'm really, really grateful. And I'll never get tired of saying it. I'll never, ever get tired of saying it. I've been restored to sanity. I don't subscribe to this notion that food's going to talk to me for the rest of my life. And I don't subscribe to the notion that I let the tiger out of the cage three times a day. I don't subscribe to any of that. I just want, in the doctor's opinion, I'm sure, Terry went over it, but, we're not all the same. We're not all the same. There are, to the doctor's opinion says classifying alcoholics or compulsive overeaters is not easy to do. Some of us are in full flight from reality. Some of us are have a sound mind. We just, keep going to food for the wrong reasons. There are various personality traits that we have, and we're not all the same. And as Terry probably pointed out, the doctor's opinion, right? Doctor's opinion tells us there's lots of categories, but all of the categories for whom this process is essential for and applies to have one symptom in common. And it's not that we can't handle our emotions without eating. It's not that we're in full flight from reality. The one symptom that we have in common is the abnormal reaction we have to certain foods, certain ingredients, and certain behaviors. And I am not, my problem is not addiction. I'm going to say that again because it might sound confusing, but my problem is not addiction. See, I didn't compulsively overeat every 5 minutes. Right? The word addiction means that I'm either physically or mentally dependent upon a substance, and when I stop using it, I'll have withdrawals. Right? So who here can stop using food without having an adverse reaction? Nobody. Right? The problem for me is not addiction. The problem for me is what I'm addicted to. Right? I'm addicted to certain substances, certain ingredients, and certain behaviors, right? I don't get the phenomenon of craving from eating an extra ounce of broccoli. I don't get the phenomenon of craving from eating an extra carrot or not weighing my string beans, right? I get the phenomenon of craving from certain foods, certain ingredients, and certain behaviors that are unique to me. I learned from a recovered compulsive overeater that the delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. Right? So I don't have to pretend, yeah, we all have the same thing. We don't. There are people here that can eat stuff I'll never be able to eat. And there are people here that can't do things with food that I'll never be able to, that I can do. And that's just the reality of the circumstance, right? So I'm a compulsive overeater. That means that regardless of whatever plans I have, whatever intentions, whatever virtues, whatever resources I enlist, whatever groups I join, whatever how many phone calls I make or meetings I go to, I make a decision to pick up the foods that my experience tells me I am unable to use safely. I can't control the quantity once I pick them up. right? That doctor's opinion told us that the doctor feels, the doctor who gets paid to fix people is telling us that we're beyond human aid. He can't fix us. Right? Bill's story, there is a solution in Bill's story where the first two chapters of the big book that were written. They were the basis of our textbook. And they used them to go around and try to sell this concept of the big book. Right? So it's basically lays out the essence of alcoholism, right? And Bill's story just simply tells the story of an ambitious, smart leader of men that got whittled down because of this condition and found that regardless of his good character, he found he couldn't do anything about his alcoholism. And a friend told him that if he was really a drunk, he was going to need to find a power greater than himself that will relieve his alcoholism. Right? So here's the good news, right? That you sum up all of Bill's story. Here's the good news. It tells us that there is a solution. Right? There is a solution. But lots of times with good news also comes bad news because this ain't it. See what we're doing here? What we're doing? This is fellowship. Those phone calls we make, those reviews that we do, that we send out to other people, those trainings that we join, they're all fellowship. The book said the fellowship is human power. The book says that there is no human power that can relieve this. So we have to understand. See, there is a solution. Well, first of all, let's just think about it for a reason. There is a solution. It starts with we. Why does it start with we? Does that mean that we all have to do it together the same way, that this requires the dependence on our fellows? Well, not according to what we read in the doctor's opinion, not according to what Bill wrote, not according to this chapter or the following chapters. It starts with we because while the book was essentially authored by Bill Wilson, it doesn't say anywhere in the book by Bill Wilson. It's presented as being authored by the first 100 AA members. And they recovered, right? They recovered. So lots of the words in the big book, it uses different tense. It uses certain words. It uses certain punctuation. And it's not the job of Overeaters Anonymous to change up those words or add punctuation to make the literature align to our personalities, right? In our invitation to you, in Overeaters Anonymous, it says we change two words. That's it. Alcohol to food and alcoholic to compulsive overeater. Right. So like I said, friends, fellows, like-minded people and people similarly afflicted, they're definitely an element of the solution, but they are not the solution in its entirety. Right, because it tells us right where it opens up, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. And that common solution is that we have found a power that can solve our problem. And if we don't embrace that, if we don't embrace that concept, well, you're going to be like me. It took me 12 years to get a year abstinent. I couldn't go 30 days without breaking my abstinence, right? Because I never took the disease as serious as it needs to be taken. And here's the other thing we have to remember. AA, OA, these are not the first movements to try to do something about the conditions, right? Because before AA, there were Washingtonians. There were Oxfords, there was that temperance movements, right? Several came before AA. And there might be ones that come after. And I have to remember, let's say all the Zoom meetings close. Let's say all the phone lines go down. Let's say the 10-step trains get stalled. I don't have a ticket. I still got this disease. I still need a defense. And that defense must come from a power greater than me. Right? And if we're all getting together claiming to be powerless, right? If we're all dead batteries, we don't start one flashlight. We don't have the necessary power. And we got to be super careful not to put the fellows and the fellowship and the connection ahead, the dependence on those ahead of where the dependence needs to be. And the dependence needs to be on a power greater than ourselves. Right? Because, like, there is a solution. You know what's interesting? The book says there's a solution. Right? I'm sorry. The chapter says there is a solution, but like almost 80% of the chapter is about the conditions. Right? Almost, it's almost the whole thing's about the condition. And you know why? Because the chapter tells me the disease centers in my mind, and my mind will always minimize the significance of this condition for lots of reasons, right? One of them is because they give the substance that I'm that causes the phenomenal craving to me. I could buy it anywhere. I could get it at doctor's offices. They put it in my vitamins. They put it in foods just to make me buy more of them, right? It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And the diligence and requirement to make sure that it does, that I don't ingest it is significant. And it takes work. And I don't like to work, right? I like you to work, and I like to take credit for what you did, right? I like to hear what you said, and then I like to repeat it like it was something that I thought of, right? I don't like to do what I have to do to ensure that I don't ingest a substance that triggers the phenomenon of craving. Right? This chapter, it gets deeper into alcoholism as a progressive illness that affects both the mind and the body. And guess what? It also affects every life that touches the person that has it. Right? It's in this disease, we're often disconnected from our loved ones. We deprive those about us who are actually are re Who, you know, who we actually are, replacing it with some character we pretend to be. Right? Many who suffer from it find themselves unable to stop despite their best efforts. I did everything I could think of to overcome this illness, including surgeries, medications. I bought drugs that people made in their kitchen sinks, put them in my body, think it would do something about my condition. Right? I compromised my morals under the influence of the substance to do things that I wouldn't repeat to anybody. Right? This disease caused me to become a, sh a like it did to Bill, who started off as a capable leader of men and whittled him down to a nub of a person. And that's what this disease did to me. And they give this stuff out in my kids' school to keep them busy between classes. Right? And what I had to realize is that, you know what? I have to accept that many of them don't have what I have. Right? Not the substances don't affect everybody the same way. So the big book describes it as it describes the mental part of our condition as an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body, right? And that, you know, I don't want to I don't want to minimize the importance of our fellowship. It is fellowship, but the fellowship is not program. The program are the steps. Fellowship is an aspect of the solution, but it's not the solution entirely, right? Because here's what it is. This is what the fellowship is for. See, we as people who suffer from the condition and found the solution, we are uniquely qualified, right? We can help each other understand each other in ways that other people aren't able to, right? On page 18 says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution can easily win over the confidence of another sufferer. And I'm paraphrasing here, right? So the fellowship, it provides a supportive community of individuals who understand the struggle, right? We share our experience, we offer help. It's a core principle, right? Because on page 20, it says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon, can you guys still hear me?
Yes.
Depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. How fortunate are we that we have a fellowship, an organization where we can both be helped and be helpful. And what I've learned as part of the solution and part of having my spiritual experience is I go to the fellowship to try to be helpful. Because if I show up thinking I have to be helped, I might be. I might be. But if I show up willing to be helpful, I always get help. I always get what I need, right? I'm showing up to be of service. You know, if you look on page 20, I'm just going to point to a couple things. You don't have to go there, right? You know, it has discussions, right? You know, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We'll tell you what we've done before going to a detailed discussion. It'll tell us all these different reasons, like practical things, right? Practical and rational things. I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman and quit? Why don't you fellow that fellow can't handle his food? Why don't you try something else? Lay off, right? Those are really, really commonplace observations for about 90% of the public. But it says here, these are commonplace observations on drinkers. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. I had a misunderstanding of this for 12 years in Overeaters Anonymous. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours, right? The doctor's opinion says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's all men and women get an effect. I get ease and comfort from every meal I eat. Everything I eat, especially the longer I am away from the last one I had, the more restless, irritable, and discontented I get. You know why? Because I'm a human being. I'm a man and a woman. You know what I mean? I'm one of those. See, effect is the result of something happened. That's what effect means. But what we have is an abnormal reaction, and a reaction is a response to something. See, I have an abnormal response, not an abnormal effect, and that response is the phenomenon of craving. Response is a, I mean, re reaction refers to a response to stimuli, right? So that's what I have to remember. I don't have to be afraid that I'm not a compulsive overeater because I love food. I was on a meeting the other day, actually Friday, and there was a girl, she got COVID or something, and she lost her sense of taste. So she thought, well, if I can't taste the food, I should be able to eat whatever I want. She had no taste whatsoever. So she went into her alcoholic foods. Didn't light up, didn't call to her. She just ate them. She just ate them. And you know what happened? No taste. She got the phenomenon of craving. She had a reaction to the substance, and the phenomenon of craving kicked in, and she couldn't stop. And now she can't get a day. She didn't do that because she wasn't weighing or measuring her emotions. She didn't do that because she didn't do enough 10 steps or didn't talk to her sponsor about it. She did it because she didn't take the disease as serious as the disease needed to be taken, or she didn't understand the details of the disease. Right? It's the reaction. Right? And this chapter, it's fantastic. It's such a key chapter because it explains the differences. Right? It tells us that, you know, there are drinkers who drink a lot, but they're not alcoholic. And there are eaters, you know, there are eaters who eat a lot. There are people who are morbidly obese who don't have an abnormal reaction. They just eat too much, right? Because you can't take a blood test, probably even a lie detector test, to determine if you have this condition. And no nutritionist or sponsor or fellow can convince you if you have this condition, right? It says moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have good enough reason for it. They can take it or they can leave it alone. That's what a moderate drinker is. I've seen plenty of moderate eaters that are 25 and 30 and 40 pounds overweight. I mean, shit, our society, the society's almost 70% overweight anyway, with morbid obesity being almost 50%. That's it. There's a reason why Nabisco is a multi-billion dollar company, and Entenmann's and Petrich Farms and Domino's Pizza, right? And it's not because everybody's a compulsive overeater, right? It says there's hard drinkers. He may have the habit badly enough and to gradually impair him physically and mentally, it may cause him to die a few years before his time. If sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this person can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult. He may even have to go get medical attention. But if the reason is strong enough, that person can give it up. Right? It tells us, it says that, and then you have what I am. And I'm not saying it, I suspect it might be what you are too, but I don't want to, it says we don't call anybody this thing, but if you're here on a Saturday, on this beautiful Saturday, you might be, right? It says he may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Once he starts to drink, right? What happens? Terry went over it. Got the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving. Look, here's the thing. It's not the job of the big book to explain to people where it comes from, right? It doesn't say anywhere that we inherit it. It's not, it, you know, is it energy? Could I have been predisposed to it? I don't know. Does it come from not being able to handle my emotions or thoughts? I don't know. I don't know. I ate when I was happy. I ate when I was sad. I ate when I was lonely. I ate when it was crowded full of people. I ate. They call it phenomena because phenomena means we know it exists, but we don't know where it comes from. And it's not the job of the steps to help me understand, maybe for you, but it's not the job of the steps to help me understand the origin of the condition. Because guess what? Understanding the origin of the condition is not the solution. Right? Lack of knowledge wasn't our problem. Lack of power is our dilemma. It tells us in the chapter the condition doesn't discriminate by age, gender, background, or social status. Like I said, the origin are unknown, right? There's no provable evidence that it's been inherited, right? I think I caught my disease from an open refrigerator. That's where I got it from. I don't know, right? But so many individuals who were once successful in many areas of their lives, they find themselves like absolutely powerless, right? What makes us different than those 90% of the other people is not what goes on in our mind before we take the bite. What makes us different is what happens in our mind after we take the bite. Right on page 22, it says, we are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. Right? What did it tell us in the doctor's opinion? Again, it tells us on page XXVI in my book, it says we got psychopaths in here. We got emotionally unstable people here. We got people that are depressive. We have people that feel out of place and some people that are entirely normal in every single circumstance, except in what happens to them after they take the bite. And to me, there is a solution It emphasizes the necessity for entire abstinence under any and all condition. But it also tells us that the main problem, right? So, regardless of where we fall in terms of the categories that I mentioned earlier or the classifications, regardless of where we fall there, if we don't take the first bite, okay, so it tells us that the problem centers in the mind. See, we get to a point from using the substances that we're unable to see the reality of our situation or the condition, or of the condition, and we decide to take the bite anyway, right? So on page 23, it says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. There's the obsession. This is what he tells us. This is the obsession that somehow, someday, they'll beat the game. A certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is ever suspected, right? Because the disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. The substances are cunning, baffling, and powerful. It tells us on page 24, we lose the power to make a choice. Willpower becomes practically non-existent. Practically, what does practically means? It means almost. Almost. You know why? Because we're going to need it. We're going to need it. Not that willpower is going to be sufficient to put down the substance, but I'm going to need my will. I'm going to need my will to take the action necessary. For the day, I'm going to need my will to take myself away from the proximity of food, right? The power we need, the power that does things for us, but it does what we can't do, not what we can do, right? So that's why it says practically, it doesn't mean entirely. See, what it says here is that the con what we have to understand is like the We, regardless of the consequences, the intended outcomes, the commitments we make, it all gets tossed out the window and replaced with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people handle themselves. And we're going to hear more about alcoholism, that we're not like other people. We'll never be like other people. And I'm grateful for that. Again, when this sort of thinking in this chapter, it says, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendency, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. And unless locked up, right? So we're all humans. So is my sponsor. So is my fellows. They're all humans. They may die or go permanently insane. You know, if the main problem centers in the mind, it's practical, isn't it practical and logical to believe that then we need to work on the mind, right? We need to work on the mind, adopt a new code of morals, embrace a better philosophy of life, right? Shouldn't that do it? I got new practices in place, got new people stood up to help me. Shouldn't that do it? See, that's not what it, see, the problem is the solution that they talk about. It's not practical or logical. It's spiritual. Right? The doctor's opinion told us that it'd be a psychic change, which relates to the spirit. Right? The spirit has to change, not my knowledge of the condition or information about the solution. My spirit has to change. And that doesn't happen by wishing or hoping. Or I'm sorry, it happens by one, getting entirely abstinent. You know, alcoholics, they didn't weigh and measure alcohol in any quantity whatsoever. And I spent 12 years in Overeaters Anonymous weighing and measuring alcoholic foods. Right? I went to the OA sanctioned nutritionist, right, who told me that this is my meal plan. and this is what you have, this is when you eat it, and this is how much you eat, right? She was the person, right? So it had to be true, but I couldn't realize that. Why did I eat breakfast and then 30 minutes later insist that I have lunch and then eat lunch and then 15 minutes later biting my lip hoping that I get to dinner?
5 minutes, Pete.
See, what I never got was I followed what you did, and that didn't serve me. I had to identify what triggered it in me, and I had to put those down, right? The other problem I had is I did what you people said to do. Make the phone calls, have the sponsor, read the big book, write my thoughts, do all those things. Well, those are all fine and dandy. Those are fine and dandy. But what I wound up doing was putting people and practices and what's that word? What's that word? Dogma. Right? And what our fellows embrace as the narrative for recovery, I put those things. If this was my disease, I put those things here and I put the relationship with God here. If these things didn't solve my problem, well, then I'll go to God. And as soon as I made somebody else, another person, part of the solution, I realized I built a faulty foundation. I tried to build a house on a foundation that wasn't sound. You know why? Because you're always going to disappoint me. As well-intentioned as everybody is, other people are always going to disappoint me. They're not going to be able to live up to my expectations because I have unusual expectations. See, our solution, it's spiritual in nature, it's not psychological in nature. Right, it tells us that until this, I don't remember if it says it and there is a solution. It doesn't. It says it in We Agnostics. It says when the spiritual malady is straightened out, we straighten out mentally and physically. See, I came in here and I was desperate to straighten out physically and mentally. Sometimes I was desperate to straighten out mentally, sometimes or I was desperate to straighten out psychologically. But I wasn't straightened out spiritually. Right? And my spiritual malady, this is just my definition of it. My malady means disease. My spiritual disease is that, unfortunately, in spite of everything I know and everything I learned and all the observations I've made, I choose to put my trust and reliance in myself. And I've always been the source of disappointment for myself. Or I put my trust and my reliance and my dependence on my fellows, and my fellows never were able to meet my needs. And I was constantly disappointed. So what am I straightened out spiritually is that I had to put my trust and my reliance, my dependence on this power that solved my problem. You know, that's 33 minutes on my end. So I figure I probably have, a couple minutes left. I just want to emphasize, I am not, I love being recovered. Like I said, I walk a free man. I've been restored to sanity. You know, the foods that used to cripple me with fear, like, oh my God, I can't eat those. I serve them to people I love because they don't have what I have. I don't require special treatment or extra consideration. I take care of what I need to take care of. I don't ingest a substance that causes the phenomenal craving. I've gone through the steps in entire abstinence, and I have what the big book says I will have. You know, a lot of people refer to those things as promises, right? And they're not promises because promises, the word promise means that something may happen. We're going to do a best for that to occur, right? The only promises they have are the ninth step promises. Everywhere else, they're all results. They're all what's going to happen if this thing is done in entire abstinence. So I hope that somehow, some way today, I've shared something from this chapter that's consistent with what the literature says. By all means, if I said something that's inconsistent with what the literature says. And I'm not saying what your friends told you or your sponsor told you or what you understand. If I said something that's inconsistent with what the literature says, then I do hope, yeah, I came here to learn as much as I came to share. Straighten me out. Help me understand where I'm falling short. And if I'm not, if it challenges your preconceived notions of what this thing is, right? Because all of us are guilty of it. We all have confirmation bias, meaning we look at information and we're looking for it
Send
to
over
come.
reminder.
Okay, I'm going to show up with this. We come in here with information that we usually hear in the meetings, and we're looking for the literature to back up what we already know versus looking at the literature to see what it really says, right? And the literature has very clear information about the condition and even more clear information about the solution. And with that, I'm going to pass and shut up. And thank you again for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Pete, for your powerful testimony and for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today.